Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Everybody who pays any attention to football and men's basketball at colleges and universities where these supposed diversions are taken most seriously knows that both sports are marbled with rot. In Scoreboard Baby, a story of college football, crime, and corruption, Ken Armstrong and Nick Perry tell the story of how coaches, university officials, and judges, among others, enabled the men most important to the football team at the University of Washington 10 years ago to keep playing games despite transgressions and alleged transgressions ranging from drunk driving and drug abuse to rape, attempted murder, armed robbery, and wife battering. One of the players who accumulated an especially impressive list of criminal charges during and after his employment by the University of Washington's football program was Jeremy Stevens, and when I spoke with the authors of Scoreboard Baby earlier this week, I began the conversation by asking Ken Armstrong to explain why they had begun the book's prologue with a description of 74,000 fans cheering for an alleged rapist.
I thought that that moment captured the pageantry of college football juxtaposed with what was going on off the field. The irony is that while everybody was celebrating this touchdown that Stevens had just scored in this pivotal game against the University of Miami, everyone in the stands knew that he was under investigation for rape because he had been arrested by a SWAT team, and an arrest like that makes the newspapers. So it had this strange division where you have everybody celebrating what's going on the field, while there are real questions raised about what will happen with Jeremy Stevens off the field and what did he do off the field.
The police had DNA evidence on Stevens. Eyewitnesses testified to the condition of his accuser, who had apparently been drugged. Stevens bragged about what he had done, displaying the 19-year-old woman's underwear as a trophy, though he was never convicted of rape. Was the team's head coach, Rick Neuheisel, aware of any or all of this?
Well, he would have been aware of what had been reported in the newspapers at a bare minimum. If he knew that, he knew that he was under investigation. And what Neuheisel did was he told Stevens that if he wound up being charged with a felony, he would have to be suspended from the team. But in the meantime, he would be allowed to continue to play.
Another high-profile player on the team, Jeremiah Farms, was being investigated in connection with an armed robbery during which a man was shot and nearly killed. In researching your book, what did you learn about the inclination of prosecutors to pursue an indictment of Jeremiah Farms?
But what we found, Bill, was that there was a pattern going back at least several years where the prosecutor's office had been taking a pass on charging football players. There were at least six players who had been arrested or being investigated on suspicion of assault, and in each instance, they had actually not been charged by the prosecutor's office.
Nick, did this surprise you when this sort of pattern started to emerge?
Yeah, I mean, it was just amazing how many players had been charged or accused of serious crimes on that team. In fact, 24 players with a few consequences for them. Too often when crimes are reported with college players, it's about what it means for that player mm-hmm. or what it means for the team. We don't often hear the victims' voices, but in Scoreboard Baby, we hear the voice of a woman who was repeatedly beaten by her husband, a player. We hear the voice of a 19-year-old who was beaten so badly that he would wake up in the middle of the night screaming. And we hear the voice of Marie, and she's the woman that you referred to, the 19-year-old freshman who accused Jeremy Stevens of rape. And hers is an emotional and haunting story. And the words of her mother really resonate when her mother went to the prosecutor and said, "Everybody's worried about Jeremy Stevens. He's going to be a big star. Well, what about my star? What about my star who's had her heart ripped out?"
Nick, were any sports journalists or was any investigative reporter writing the stories of how various players with criminal pasts or players under investigation for felonies or players with outstanding warrants were representing Washington on the field each week?
At the time, there was a little bit of reporting here and there on isolated incidents, but nobody put this all together. So at the time of the season, little of this was known.
Nick, when Rick Neuheisel, who was the head coach of the University of Washington team 10 years ago, was asked if he had answered honestly questions about whether he'd interviewed for another coaching job, he would say his answers were, quote, narrowly honest. What did that mean?
It means that he was passing his words and that he was taking a kind of a legalistic view to honesty, which you or I might not view as entirely honest. And this was kind of a pattern with him. And in fact, in the book, we go into some blatant lies that he told about his coaching interview and things like that. But in other instances, he's talking about being honest and narrowly honest within a very legalistically defined sense.
Ken, what about that casual attitude toward honesty vis-a-vis the criminal behavior of some of the players?
Well, it had a Clinton-esque quality to it. Rick Neuheisel even later acknowledged as much. You know, he would say, for example, when he was looking at NCAA rules and what he could do and what he couldn't do when he was recruiting a player, that he was looking for loopholes and he was reading these rules like a lawyer instead of trying to appreciate the spirit of the rules. And that's what he attributed a lot of these NCAA violations that he accumulated over the years at Colorado and at the UW to. But he said that he learned from that and moved on.
Coaches often claim that sometimes players with criminal histories can be disciplined when they get into big-time college football programs and that this will help them mature and learn how to become responsible adults. Is it fair to say you found that this wasn't necessarily true of Jeremy Stevens, Terry Tank Johnson, Khalif Barnes, and various other veterans of Coach Neuheisel's mentoring?
I think that's definitely true. And I think Rick Neuheisel would say as much now. He's acknowledged that he made a mistake when he disciplined Jeremy Stevens for running his pickup truck into a retirement home. And let me repeat that. He ran his pickup truck into a retirement home, and then he drove away in the dead of night. The punishment that Rick Neuheisel opted for was simply a half-game suspension. He said since then that he wishes he had made it at least 3 games. But what was striking to me is that it wasn't just the coaches who were failing to hold players to account. It was the community as a whole and key public institutions. You had a judge who's confronted with a football player who's accused of breaking his wife's nose. And during a court hearing, the judge wants to talk about the previous year's game against Notre Dame. He's having a conversation that would be suitable for a sports bar instead of a courtroom. You had another judge who sentences a player to 30 days in jail, and the judge writes in her sentencing order to be served after the football season.
Rick Neuheisel is currently the head football coach at UCLA, where he's been making well over $1 million a year for the past 3 years. Given what you learned researching Scoreboard Baby, Ken, does that hiring surprise you?
I don't think it does, because even the athletic director at UCLA summed it up. He said, at the end of the day, it's all about 66 wins. That's how many wins Rick Neuheisel had at the time that he was hired. Mm-hmm. We tend to have short memories in the sports world. We tend to be forgiving. And Rick Neuheisel went on the sidelines, in a sense, for a while. He was an assistant coach in the NFL with the Baltimore Ravens. And after enough time passed, UCLA elected to hire him because he was an alumnus. He was going to bring excitement to UCLA. They felt like he was somebody who had the charisma to compete with Pete Carroll at that time.
Nick, nearly all of Scoreboard Baby is about what went on and off the field in Seattle with the University of Washington. But did the criminal acts and the failure to prosecute star players that you documented in the book seem unusual, or were that team and that university and that community representative of colleges invested in big-time football?
Well, we really think of this book, Scoreboard Baby, as an example of what goes on in college football. We did intense research on this team. There was 107 players on the roster, and we looked very carefully into the backgrounds and of each of those players. And I am convinced that if somebody else did a similar in-depth study of another team, they'd probably find similarly disturbing patterns going on. So we made a deliberate decision to focus on this team and to tell this one story, but we do see it as an example.
Ken, you're still in Seattle. Are you going to be signing copies of Scoreboard Baby in local bookstores?
I will be. I'll be signing copies and probably avoiding thrown vegetables.
I hope it's nothing worse than thrown vegetables.
I hope so, too.
Is there any irony involved in the fact that this book has been published by University of Nebraska Press? Because I hear there's a fairly good, albeit somewhat notorious, college football team attached to that institution.
There is some irony to it, and I think you have to give the University of Nebraska some credit for this, because even within this book, we allude to the very thing that you're describing. We talk about the Tom Osborne years and how Lawrence Phillips was allowed to return the team, even after he had dragged his girlfriend down a set of stairs by her hair. And Phillips wasn't the only player on that team who got in trouble with the law, yet was allowed to continue to play. So, yeah, there is some irony here.
Did you guys come away from writing this book with a sense that there's something sort of deeply embedded in the culture of big-time college football that just isn't going to change? Or do you think there is hope that there will be a less grotesque landscape at some future time?
Well, Bill, one thing that was interesting in researching this book was we went back looking at the Washington program, going back 100 years. There was a coach then, Gil Dobie, who went unbeaten for seven or eight seasons. And some of these same issues arose back then. And there was a player who cheated on an exam back then, and the players, they wanted him to be able to play the final championship game, and the faculty didn't want him to play, and it turned out to be a big march through Greek Row. So some of these same issues were playing out 100 years ago.
Ken, what about you? Did you come away from this optimistic or pessimistic?
Pessimistic in one sense. As Nick said, we really looked at the historical view here, and we found a lot of parallels to what was happening in 1916, to what was happening in 2000 or in 2008. Where I'm optimistic is that the UW has been very forthright in dealing with this story. They've acknowledged that what happened in 2000 represented a collective failure on the part of the university and the community, and that encompasses university administrators, coaches, faculty, the community at large. I think if the UW were to adopt a bunker mentality here, I'd be more troubled about its prospects going forward.
Is it possible to generalize about how well or how poorly some of these players are doing 10 years after the 2000 season?
That's really difficult because some are doing well. You know, we deal with the whole range of occupations that they hold now. Some are doing well. Some are hurting physically, which you deal with. They have back injuries or they're worried about concussions that they may have suffered while playing. Others, you know, we have those very sad stories, you know, about Anthony Vontor and Curtis Williams and what happened to them afterwards. So I think it is hard to generalize. It's a big range.
Ken Armstrong, the co-author of Scoreboard Baby, a story of college football crime and complicity, published by the University of Nebraska Press. Join me from KUOW in Seattle. Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
And I was also joined by co-author Nick Perry. Nick, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
My conversation with Ken Armstrong and Nick Perry, the authors of Scoreboard Baby, will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be talking with both of our football experts, Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com and Dan Wetzel of YahooSports.com, and together they will provide you with all you need to know about the 2010-2011 pro and college football seasons. We'll have a story courtesy of Only a Game's Karen Given about a reality TV program designed to provide minorities with greater opportunities to participate in NASCAR. And we'll also learn something about how hiking the long trail is bound to earn one a nickname. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio.